And then there was that other time Christian Bale yelled at people. Oh, apologies. Hello and welcome to End Credits Radio Show on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and I do not get mad when people fix the lights during a take. And joining me today is...
Vince Mazin.
And you also don't get mad at your DP when he's lighting.
No, yeah. I'm very grateful for any DP, let alone one that messes around with lights during a take. So, yeah.
Right on. End Credits is your local movie show for local movie fans, and we are back here Thursdays at 10 a.m. for the foreseeable future, and we're going to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the action comedy? Question mark? American Made?
Oh, is that what we're doing? I thought it was the Lego Ninja movie. I saw the wrong movie.
No. That's what happens when you meet staff meetings.
Yeah, I think action comedy is good.
Okay. Now that we've established you didn't see the Ninjago movie. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to tackle some movie news from the past week, which includes the Avatar sequels. Are they finally happening? And what's with the big price tag of $1 billion? Does anyone even care anymore? We'll talk about that. Then Netflix is going to spend half an Avatar sequel series on Canadian production. And we're going to talk about whether that's going to be good for the Canadian productions, people like Vince who like to work in the industry, and if that's good news there. Or is it bad news? Maybe. We'll get there. But speaking of bad news, I think you were here when we talked about Devin Faraci.
Yeah.
That was you. You've become our movie blogger harassment expert.
Well, I was just about to suggest that we should have a segment on the show for the newest, like, blogger sexual harassment scandal.
This week in harassment. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's almost there, and it's kind of sad. If you don't know what we're talking about, Harry Knowles, you may not know the name, but you probably know the site if you're a teen or in college in the 90s. He started Ain't It Cool News around that time. He was really like the first movie blogger. And the site still reflects that till this day. But that's not the serious issue that Harry Knowles has been embroiled in now. He's joined a long, sad list of people accused of sexual harassment. Three longtime contributors to the Ain't It Cool News site resigned practically immediately. Knowles himself has stepped away from Ain't It Cool, and... I guess the only real question is, like, again, like, it's, first of all, it's Austin, where this fantastic fest, you know, Ain't It Cool, obviously a sponsor of Fantastic Fest over the years, closely right. allied with the Draft House, which hosts Harry Knowles' famous annual birthday party, but Numathon. That's probably not happening this year. And, yeah, the whole Devin Faraci thing, Devin Faraci accused of her harassment, left Birth Movies Death, got it right the first time. And then was kind of secretly hired onto the Fantastic Fest writing team by his friend, Tim Leake.
Right.
And then, so, I mean, there's something, it's not just about the movie community. It seems like it's something about the movie community in Austin as well.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it also reflects the times that we're living in to a certain extent, which is to say that you just can't, like, do this stuff and get away with it anymore. Like, I was watching...
Even years later.
Right, exactly. Or if that is the kind of person that you are, you will be exposed at some point.
Yeah.
I was watching this documentary called O.J. Made in America, and one of his childhood friends was saying, this was pre-murder trial, was saying to him about some of the scandalous things that he had done, you know, in his, you know, marriage. It's like, one day everyone's going to know what you're doing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, this was pre-internet, pre-whatever. It was kind of prophesizing all of that
stuff. When it was actually
stuff.
Difficult to know what people were doing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I feel like is, or it just reminded me of this kind of stuff. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't take long for this kind of behavior to get outed now. One day everything will get exposed.
Yeah, and this woman, Jasmine Baker, you know, she said, I think she was an employee of the Draft House, and Harry Knowles inappropriately touched her, and then
right.
and then kind of giggled, which was kind of a, it was kind of a whistle to me, because he'll often write in parentheses "giggle" in his movie reviews.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like that set. That's like a small detail that sounds too true to not be true, but it's also. But then Jasmine Baker opened a floodgate because several other women.
Right.
So it's the old adage, you know. I can't remember the old adage, but it starts at the Turin, right? That one person is bold enough and brave enough to step out, and then that gives that bolsters other people to find that bravery in themselves and finally call out their attacker too.
Right. I can't imagine it's easy calling out somebody with the status like he has.
Yeah.
So I am glad that, you know, it does open the floodgates, as you say. One person comes forward, and that lets everybody else kind of,
yeah,
or gives people the comfort, rather,
right,
to do it.
Yeah, it gives them a cushion, because the hardest thing is being the first person out.
Right.
Because the inflexive reaction, or at least in the past, the inflexive reaction, I think we've seen that change, where we have seen most women come out and we see people automatically rally to the women. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think in the past, it's like, oh, well, it's one person. They could be making it up. Not to say that hasn't gone away either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we have seen that shift. But, you know, I think it's still in the back of a lot of women's minds who've been abused or assaulted, that the immediate is nobody's going to believe me, or they're going to call me a slut or what have you.
I'm wondering if it's something related to like the profession, maybe, like they're not in the public eye, so they feel maybe more entitled,
right,
to kind of, you know, engage in this kind of behavior. I just, like, this plus the Devin Faraci thing has just kind of got me thinking about it on a larger scale, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a profession thing, because we're talking about movie criticism, which is mostly white men.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And I know for a lot of women, that's, you know, just on a general relating basis, you know, going into a press screening as a woman, and, you know, there being like maybe 19, 20 men for every woman in that screening, that's of course changing too. But that comes also back to things like Gamergate. Mm-hmm. And what happened to the woman who's an editor at Marvel Comics, who, posted this innocent shot of her and some colleagues and some friends having a milkshake on a Friday afternoon, and people start attacking her about, like, well, this is why comics suck now, because there's too many women. And it's like, it's first of all, it's not this weird thing that,
right,
that, well, I guess to some guys, it's this weird thing that women might actually like comic books and might like movies and want to review or write comic books or
it's
what
like
have
you. It's like you have to be disingenuous in some way. There's no way you could possibly,
right,
like, just
exactly,
be authentically into that stuff.
Exactly. So there's already a feeling in certain communities inside these worlds that women are interlopers.
Right.
So for certain kind of people who could be predators, that makes it okay, at least in their minds.
It sounds like there's a shift happening now, though. Certainly with these stories, they're contributing to more transparency, I guess, and not just... The thing is about these things is that you see a lot of backlash, like, after they're announced, like,
yeah,
their colleagues step down. Like, it really affects a lot of other people, I think.
Yeah. And to the credit of it was Capone. I can't remember their real names, but Capone, Quinn, and Horella at AIC. Mm-hmm. Kind of left it immediately. It was like it came out at 9 o'clock, and by 11, they, you know, Quint, I think it was Quint or Capone, one of them posed a thing like, we're gone, we're done.
Right.
And it was just that simple, which is in stark contrast to the Fantastic Fest controversy, where Tim League basically screwed the pooch for,
right,
for a couple of days, and then was like, okay, he's gone again, are we cool? And it's,
and then
not
casually,
quite, yeah.
Right, yep.
And I want to point this out, too, because I think I haven't seen it reported in any of the reporting, but, you know, there's been kind of a cloud over Harry Knowles for years, not just because Ain't It Cool News lost ground to, you know, 1,000 blogs and websites that followed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to Ain't It Cool News now, which I'm not sure I recommend, but because I think all the writers are gone, but
So what's the deal? His sister is now taking over.
That's what he says.
Site? Right. Yeah. Okay.
I'm not sure what his sister knows about movies, but we're talking too about a site where it hasn't been culturally relevant, and people who use the site and post comments on the site basically will come right out and say, I'm just here to post comments and crap post and, you know, not really contribute anything to the conversation because I think, you know, because of certain thoughts about Harry Knowles that have nothing to do with the movies. A lot of people have seen him as someone who's manipulative by the studios, like persuasive by, you know, being given swag. And then there was the whole controversy with the Kickstarter. He started a Kickstarter to produce a TV show version of Ain't It Cool. And there were allegations that he used that money to pay off his back taxes and buy a car for himself.
Well, I never heard that. That is indeed scummy.
Yeah.
To put it bluntly.
So, I mean, when that compounds the other thing, because if he's scummy in this area, then he's certainly going to be scummy in it. No one's kind of like scummy in one small way, even, you know, and to, these are allegations too. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's nothing to say that maybe his uncle died and he got a check. But, you know, at the same time, you do a Kickstarter, you buy a car, you pay off your taxes, and then it takes you a year and a half to produce the thing.
Something doesn't add up.
Yeah.
And it's also like comes back to the Devin Faraci thing, I feel, too. Like, people were not like, oh, this is a huge shocker from such a kind and, like,
right,
level-headed individual. They were all like, well, you were kind of...
He was a jerk to people.
A jerk beforehand, too.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if that just... is the persona that you have to adopt when you're doing that or what, but...
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of jerks, James Cameron. I kid. Not really. He... Finally, we got some news this week. Avatar, the sequels. He's making four sequels kind of back-to-back for Avatar. They started shooting this week. I'm still of the opinion, I will believe it when I am sitting in the movie theater watching it, that it's happened. But having said that, it was a big announcement. They showed a cast photo of some of the new people, not as like their actual characters, just like, here's some fresh-faced youngsters. And then Sam Worthington's back, so is Zoe Saldana, Sigourney Weaver, Stephen Lang, CCH Pounder. Half those people, their characters were killed in the first film, so I'm not sure how they're coming back.
Right.
But, spoiler alert for Avatar, but... I think the big thing people are focusing on is like $1 billion. That this has been greenlit, $1 billion for these movies, which is about $250 million a piece. And I found
which
this,
I think comes out to roughly what the first one costed.
Roughly what the first one costed, but generally when you shoot things back to back, it's so you can stifle costs. As the
so he is shooting all four simultaneously the way that. Right. Peter Jackson did with the Lord of the Rings and,
right.
and whatnot.
Incidentally, which was the last series that had the highest budget greenlit at $623 million. Although the series, despite a lot of people not liking The Hobbit, did make almost $3 billion back. So not a loss by any stretch.
So I'm curious, actually, were you reviewing professionally at the time Avatar came
yes.
out? You had to review it for some sort of publication?
Yes.
What was your impression of it?
I thought it was visually stunning, but I did not find the story particularly engaging.
Right. And that's, I think, what... I think that's what I'm concerned as well for these, because the technology at the time was so cutting edge, I feel.
Yeah, he was ahead
like
of the game.
The 3D stuff. And the story was like, you know, it was what it was, but I think that combined with the visuals is what made it really great. This time, it's like, now that the visuals, I feel, are... Or perhaps the technology is... we're more familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
Is the story still going to be there?
That's a great question, because I feel like Avatar is to James Cameron what the Star Wars prequels are to George Lucas, where it became so focused on the technology and so
right.
technology-driven in terms of realizing the vision.
That's a good comparison.
The human
actually,
elephant
yeah.
gets lost.
Right.
Because say what you want to about Titanic. It was an expensive film. It was featured a lot of... visual effects technology, and there was certainly a lot of innovation going on that set too. That's what James Cameron does. He doesn't just shoot a thing. He helps develop the technology to shoot his films,
right?
Which, you know, to his credit, good for him. But there was still a human element in that. You know,
yes.
Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet, the chemistry was off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a lot of great character actors in it, like Jonathan Hyde as the guy who owned the Titanic, and Victor Garber as the guy who designed the Titanic. Their real names can't escape me. I apologize. Kathy Bates as the unsinkable Molly Bloom. You know, Billy Zane, even as the villain, even though he's like a cardboard cutout villain, Billy Zane was insanely, you know, over the top, excellent. In that movie.
I think that's where everyone most recognizes Billy Zane. I don't remember seeing him in anything after Titanic.
Zoolander cameo.
Oh, true. Yeah. Sorry.
Zoolander. Which, I mean, hey, it's he's not a one-hit wonder. poor Billy Zane. But, yeah, to put it in comparison, though, again, people focus on the billion-dollar number, and it's like, well, the Fast and the Furious, the last one, Fate of the Furious, was itself $250 million. So you get one Fate. So basically, one Avatar sequel is one Fate of the Furious movie.
Right.
So when you kind of compare it to that, it's maybe not so huge. And it's not like James Cameron's an unknown quantity. Twice now, he's gone through the studio, asked for a huge budget, gotten the budget. Everyone was expecting folly and disaster, and it exceeds expectations, and it makes billions of dollars.
I'm just like four movies, like four sequels, I feel is a lot. If he was talking about the next one in the franchise and focusing like exclusively on that, there would be no doubt in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about the four movies that's gotten me a little bit concerned.
Yeah.
Maybe they're getting, I don't know. I'm not sure quite how to articulate the concern. Maybe they're just getting, biting off more than they can chew, maybe. I don't know.
Well, you could be right, except I think the release date for the first one is 2020.
Right.
And so that's 3 years away. Then it's 2021. Then they take 3 years off and do the last two in 2024 and 2025. So maybe there's some kind of, point of no return between the two sets of sequels, that if the first two aren't as profitable or aren't as successful, that the studio can pull the plug and say, okay, enough of this Avatar nonsense. But I'm right there with you. This does seem like extraordinary hubris for James Cameron. Because do you remember, it was a couple of years ago, but there was the whole debate about cultural relevancy, about Avatar, about how nobody really talks about Avatar. And, nobody's quoting the movie, and don't see people dressed as Navi for Halloween.
Right,
still.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can still see kids dressed as Luke Skywalker or Indiana Jones, but you're not going to see a Navi at Halloween, I guarantee you.
I guess the blunt kind of question is, do people still care about those movies? 2025 is a long time to be with this series, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's interesting, actually. I hadn't heard that debate, but that is that's very true. I remember when that came out, it was like you had to see that movie in order to be a part of this kind of – it was an event. You
right.
You know what I mean? You had to see it to be a part of this international conversation that was going on.
And Jeffrey Katzenberg said it was going to be start the third sort of revolution in cinema.
Which, yep.
The first was sound, the second was color, and this was going to be the third, with the 3D and the advanced computer technology and the motion capture and all that. And I feel like that has happened to an extent.
Right.
But nobody's kind of going back to Avatar. Nobody's mentioning the Avatar in the same way people talk about the jazz singer as something that got, that brought sound to the mainstream, or something like The Wizard of Oz, which had a tremendous amount of color in it, which was one of the first movies to just feature that amount of color. Gone with the Wind as well. 3D is huge. Maybe not as big as it was in 2010, 2011, 2012. But that started a revolution, even if it was just kind of a pure profit motive revolution in terms of studios thinking, people love 3D. We'll just turn this into 3D and people will love it. And I think that flaked pretty quickly. It certainly flaked for me because I saw, what was it? It was a Wes Craven, one of the Wes Craven's last movies. It wasn't Scream 4. It was My Soul to Take.
Right, okay.
And they converted that into 3D, and it was utterly unwatchable in 3D. It was so dark. I watched it without the 3D glasses. It was so dark. It was. And so, you know, the studios kind of went hog wild with it, and, you know, voila.
Because, like, there was 3D prior to Avatar.
Oh, sure.
And I was not even, like, really that fond of it at that time.
Yeah.
Avatar kind of, I don't want to say converted me, but it certainly opened my mind to the possibilities of 3D.
Yeah, it made it viable, right?
Yeah.
And there's still, I try to avoid 3D now, but if I hear somebody say, there are certainly movies that have good 3D. I think one of them would probably be Dread.
Yeah.
That had good use of 3D.
I thought Life of Pi was also
Life
pretty
of Pi,
decent.
Yeah. Even like the third Transformers movie, which isn't great, but it had great 3D in it.
Right.
It was a great theatrical experience. So, but, you know, there are a ton of movies that really don't need it, really shouldn't bother. But, I mean, because it's now kind of pro forma, if you're doing a big tentpole release, you gotta do it in 3D, even if it wasn't shot in 3D. Although I wonder how many movies are actually shot in 3D.
Same with like IMAX, same with other kind of
that's true too
formats like that. How many of them are actually shot with that and not just re-edited, so to speak?
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of revolutions, my segues are terrible. Anyway, Melanie Jolie, we don't usually do politicky things, although I get with the first story. It's like one of the things, just for a quick aside, one of the reasons I started this show was, you know, I want to get on the radio and not talk about things that make me sad.
Right.
And this stuff happens. This next story doesn't necessarily make me sad, but yes. it's again, the Venn diagram is shifting again.
Who has been accused of sexual assault this time?
Yes. It's sad. Anyway, so Melanie Jolie, who is the heritage minister, she announced that there's some changes to the Canadian Media Fund, and this is a fund that musicians and filmmakers and book writers can access to help, you know, make them make a living in order to do their art. The biggest takeaway from all this was that apparently the government's reached a deal with Netflix to spend $500 million over 5 years in Canada to make Canadian productions, although the definition of that is unclear.
The CMF is getting the money, or they are just affiliated
It's a two-parter. CMF is changing its rules to make it a bit easier to access funds. But I think this is Netflix itself having negotiated with the Canadian government. I imagine there's probably going to be particular tax benefits for them in the end to do production here in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But they're spending the $500 million.
Right, okay.
But they'll see benefits like the dollar. Their dollar will go further.
Right.
Because I think it's 81 cents right now for every American dollar. So that's one aspect. And then the other aspect is, you know, there are fairly generous. And this goes for places in the United States as well. Depending on where you go, there are more generous tax credits than other places. And I think probably that's going to be something Netflix can take advantage of.
Well, I don't think they have to. There was something about them abiding by these kind of laws that we have in, or at least like whatever legislations that say you have to have a certain amount of Canadian content,
right,
or it has to be pertinent to, you know, our culture in some way.
Right. There are CanCon rules for our TV channels that don't necessarily exist for Netflix.
Right. When I was in school, a teacher of mine who used to write for a show on CBC was saying that to get past those kind of things, you mm-hmm. could just put like a Canadian flag on a building, you know, or something. He wrote like some sort of street racing script that was set in Los Angeles, and, you know, he changed it to Toronto just to kind of appease them.
Right.
It seems like it's more of a, and maybe this is, you know, a bit off topic, but it seems like it's more of a hassle than it is actually encouraging us to explore our own stories. You know?
Right. It's a checklist where you have to have a certain number of, like, the lead actors or the lead speaking parts Canadian, right. played by Canadian actors, or the director has to be Canadian, or the producers or the writers have to be Canadian, or the location has to be a Canadian location.
Right.
You know, what's the weird thing about it is, I think you're right. I think the stuff that that connects has nothing to do with the checklist. You
right.
know, it's just what people are going to find appealing, and I think that's as difficult to do without the checklist as it is with the checklist, because you know, there are things like that are like Canadian Toronto set, things like the Murdoch Mysteries. My mom's a fan of the Murdoch Mysteries. She'll go on the Murdoch Mysteries Facebook page, and there are like hundreds of fans who are American and British.
Right.
And, you know, it may not, you know, there's a certain Toronto elitism I found to some of the coverage of this. Like, Canadian production. You know, what are we going to do? Get more Corner Gas or Murdoch Mysteries? I was listening to Canada Land, and Jesse Brown was going on about Rick Mercer. He's like, I've never found him perfect. I've never laughed one thing. And I said, well, maybe you haven't. But they kept Rick Mercer on TV for like 50 years with 22 minutes. And he did this great show, Made in Canada, which is about, you know, the Canadian film industry.
Right.
And then he's done his Rick Mercer Report show. So somebody's finding Rick Mercer funny. It's not necessarily people in Toronto. A lot of people find Rick Mercer funny. It's like, I'm sorry you don't get it, but, you know, Canada's a bigger place than Toronto, although they're wont to admit it.
Yes. Yes. I don't know if I can vouch for that, having lived there the time that I did, but whatever. With that being said, though, is there something, like, is there something to be said for the kind of content that they are making? Like, they're obviously not attracting a young audience the way that American TV is. Like, I saw this, whatever it was, Beaverton article about, you know, it was spoofing the fact that they were adapting another, like, 100-year-old novel into a TV show. And it's like, yeah, like, I hope this money gets basically gets used to do something very, like, creative and unique. And
well, again, that's maybe where the Netflix comes into play.
Right.
Because Netflix has their metrics and their data, and they don't share that because it's Netflix and it's a black box and they don't want to and they don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of why I find it interesting what this might develop. I'm skeptical, of course, because it could mean that they're just going to, you know, do, like, move Master of None or something to Toronto and call it New York or something like that,
right.
Which would theoretically count when we're using the checklist. Or are they going to do something like, I don't know, like Murdoch Mysteries or like Lost Girl or something on Showcase? Showcase was doing a lot of great stuff for a while, Lost Girl, like Continuum. Endgame is a particular favorite of mine. It lasted one season, but it was great. It was Vancouver set. It had a Canadian flavor, but it was a murder mystery show. So theoretically, it was supposed to have universal appeal. But it's hit or miss. And I think the trick with the Canadian industry is that we sort of beatify every success. It's not just a success. It's like a huge success. And then every loss we take profoundly personally, and it kind of shuts down the industry. It's like, I guess we're just not going to bother making TV shows anymore. And I think that's where Netflix comes into play, because Netflix clearly can do more with less.
Right. And if it were up to me, like, half of that money would be allocated to Kenny versus Benny to get a new season on Netflix. But it's probably better that I'm not. You know, we don't have those two guys with, like,
with motion.
$100 million.
Yeah. Kenny versus Benny with motion capture. Yeah. And it's all set on Pandora. That'd be great. We're going to take a break and play some music here, and then come back, right back with our review of American Made. And to get you in the mood, here is American Money from the Bournes, or Bjorns. There's like a accent there, so I'm not going to...
Don't even try.
I'm not going to try. Yeah, so American Money, it is from their 2015 album, Dopamine. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
come to see. So I think there's been some sort of mistake here because these fellas just picked me up at the airport.
No mistake. Just please, have a seat. Coffee, Mr. Seal?
You know my name?
You're the gringo who flies to Central America every week. Taking pictures very low with your fancy plane.
Those photos, see, I have a aviation company here in South America.
Yes, AIC.
IAC, yes, sir.
Or is it CIA?
What? No. I'm just a businessman here.
I'm a businessman. Imports, exports, cattle, horses. But now God above has blessed this great country with new riches, Mr. Seal. And you could help us.
And that is a clip from American Made. It is the new film from one Doug Liman, and it stars Tom Cruise and Domhnall Gleeson, based on the real-life exploits of Barry Seal, who, if you've seen a picture of him, looks nothing like Tom Cruise.
No. There have actually been multiple books, I think, and documentaries about the real guy.
Yeah, yes.
Looks nothing like him.
He is not a Tom Cruise doppelganger.
pretty sure he signed on just so he could fly like a plane. That was his strategy.
Well, I think, let's first describe the film. It's based on Barry Seal, who was contracted by the CIA to fly over various sites in Central America and get spy photos. But he decided to go into a side business for himself, running drugs for the group that ended up being the cartel of Pablo Escobar. And then the CIA said, well, if you're going to be doing that, we're going to get you to send guns to the Contras, and then we're off to the races. And the whole thing ended up in front of a Senate hearing around Contra, which is a very famous Contra. How much did you know about the history of this, by the way, about the 80s and Iran-Contra?
Oh, very little.
Yeah.
And it actually opens with kind of a great little montage of just establishing 80s culture right off the bat.
Yeah, where America was in 78. It was interesting.
So I was very unfamiliar with the real story, but as they usually do with this stuff, I was kind of aware of the fact that they were embellishing and or heightening a lot of it.
Yeah. There was definitely some embellishment, and not just because Tom Cruise does not look like Barry Seal, but just to say that again. Yeah, so the thing I'll say about Cruise is, maybe he did this so he can fly a plane, and I don't know. But what I will say, and you were here for The Mummy, too.
Right, yes.
He was far more engaged in this than he was in anything going on in The Mummy.
Yes.
He looked like he was having fun, and he looked like he was being challenged. This is another great thing where he's kind of playing against type. He's without his shirt at one point, so we can see how musculature he is still at, in his mid-50s. But
that's a contractual obligation.
It is a contractual obligation. But although Barry Seal, in this anyway, is cut, he is still a regular guy. He has moments where he is frantic, where he is under the gun, and he is not in control. And you can hear from the clip, he was not a highly trained CIA specialist at all. He was just
right.
He was literally a guy they pulled out of the airport lounge. And I think I like seeing Tom Cruise like that.
Yeah. And
being a little more vulnerable than he is, say, in the Mission Impossible movies.
Yeah, and It's strange because I've always identified Tom Cruise as a movie star, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I remember as a kid seeing Mission Impossible. It didn't matter what Tom Cruise was in. It was Tom Cruise sold the movie. You went and saw the new Tom Cruise movie, or at least I did.
It was his face.
Yeah, exactly. So, and going back to The Mummy, I feel like he was getting into a very safe kind of space where he was taking on these projects that were not very artistically challenging, I guess.
Yeah, good way to phrase it.
And this one is just so much fun.
Yeah.
It looked like, to go back to your point, it looked like he was having fun and I was having a great time as well.
And you know what I thought, but you know what I thought after that was, am I having too much fun?
Yeah.
Because it's about, it's a bit, it's a, first of all, there's kind of this corporate culture to the CIA. That's the way it's portrayed. It's, you know, the way they kind of cut ties with him at the end. And I don't think we're spoiling anything because you can easily find Barry Seal's real life story.
Right, yeah.
But there's this very corporate thing at the CIA. There's a scene where Gleason, where they're going over Barry Seal's photos, and the head spy is like, well, who took these photos? And Gleason's like, oh, that's my guy.
Yeah.
And it seems like he's kind of scoring points because then he goes back to his cubicle and the guy next to him's like, screw you for you, your guy, and getting your great photos. And it's you know, not, I don't think that's really how spies want to sort of be portrayed in that kind of petty light. And then on the flip side of it is, it's like this kind of American dream on steroids where he turns this job into an empire. Where you see the scenes where he's making so much money, he's like burying it in his backyard, and
it's almost like a Wolf of Wall Street.
It is
Tom
a Wolf
Cruise
of Wall Street, yeah.
Type thing.
It's bizarre like that. There's a scene where he's like digging up his yard to bury another sack, and he inadvertently digs up a sack of money, and he's like, "Oh, jeez," and he's got money everywhere, and.
Because he's flying for the TWA initially.
Right.
He's kind of bored with.
Right, he's
his
bored,
position.
And his wife is expecting, so it's, you know, he's not making a lot of money. It's a very 9-to-5-y job, even though he's flying planes.
Right.
That's telegraphed fairly quickly that he needs some, like, and it's also implied that he's kind of a hotshot, that he was a very accomplished young pilot. And I think Gleason, going over, like, his background, is like, well, you were the youngest pilot TWA ever hired. So,
right.
You know, there's another aspect of the American dream is like where you start out and you're great and you're the rookie sensation and then you plateau out and life just becomes a drag. So there are all these little subtexts going on. But once you're watching it, it's like you're watching The Hangover almost.
It's quite frantic.
It is frantic.
And if there is one complaint that I have, actually, it's that they don't kind of pause and like develop his character the way
right.
that I feel. I get the sense that there was a lot of stuff that was cut, maybe some political stuff, maybe some of the bigger characters, not to be too spoilerish, but I'm kind of torn between that, actually.
Yeah.
I was doing a, sorry to cut you off, I was doing a script at one point about like a deep sea diver, true story.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously this was a person that like was really got a lot of kicks out of thrilling kind of dangerous stuff like this.
Right.
And so I had to kind of delve into, because I'm so unlike that, I had to kind of, I felt like that's what the movie was really about. It was like what goes on in the mind of this character that is so thrilled by these kind of experiences.
Yeah.
And this movie obviously doesn't really want to explore that side. It kind
right.
of just, you know.
There's a be careful what you wish for factor in it, because we can all identify with Barry, you know, coming home from work and just plopping down on mm-hmm. the bed and
yeah.
falling asleep, even as your wife comes in a negligee, clearly ready for some things. But then he gets into the racket. And he becomes a pawn of the CIA. And, you know, everyone kind of like, yes, the exciting life and, you know, getting shot at and the adrenaline rush and making all this money. And, it does sort of it's sort of a parable like that. Be careful what you wish for, because he had everything. And then, you know, he was almost victimized by his own ambition because it got too big. Too fast, and the rug ended up being pulled out from under him and forced him to do something that was probably ill-advised and something that his friend, you know, advises him, like, hey, we're going to get into big trouble for this.
Right.
And then it does.
But this one, I felt, was more, like, tightly structured, more
yes.
Entertaining than something like War Dogs, which
right.
is, like, along the same kind of premise, I guess,
yes.
of in the sense that it's these people getting caught up in some greater scheme than what they originally intended, kind of thing. But it's also kind of depressing that I feel like this movie is not gonna, it's just gonna kind of come and go for
yeah.
some reason. I got that impression, and
yeah.
it really is like just a very entertaining, fun film.
Yeah, I have that feeling too, but I think that comes from the lightness of it,
right? Yeah,
because it's just it's so much fun, and it kind of goes by, and the pacing is excellent.
Yeah,
And that's that, and I do find that in these kind of like biopics. I'm not sure you'd call this a biopic, but it takes place over probably about 8-9 years,
and it's got like a voiceover. He does like kind of a voiceover, like Ray Liotta in Goodfellas, in some ways.
Good comparison, but yeah, but because it takes place over different years, different locations. It doesn't drag as it's trying to transition, you were able to keep up with it as well, because I think that's the difficulty with these things. How do you kind of keep up the momentum of the story as you're sort of telling different scenes over years and months and years? And it did that very, very well. Doug Liman also, who directed this, this is kind of his wheelhouse, where it's like we're like cramming a spy story into real life, because Bourne Identity is like that. Granted, it's about top level assassins and CIA covert ops, but there's also the aspect to it where Matt Damon ends up in the girl's car and she's driving him to Paris, and she gets roped into this world where everyone's trying to kill you, and when you walk into somewhere, you gotta know where all the exits are and where the cameras are. And Mr. and Mrs. Smith too, which is also this like boring suburban life for this couple who are leading these secret lives that neither of them know about.
He's obviously got an affinity for people who have like alternate identities or something, because he also did the one with Emily Blunt and Tom Cruise.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow as well.
Yeah. Which is another great Tom Cruise, not as Tom Cruise part.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Because he's a coward in that.
Yeah.
And who has to learn the battle skills. And that was a very un-Tom Cruise part. But you're right. This is an interesting partnership going forward.
Yeah. And great editing, it has to be said. Like you said, the pace is just wonderful. Same editor as Sixth Sense.
Different pace.
Yeah, just a little bit.
And it has such a great sense of time without bashing you over the head with it.
Yes.
Another 80s spy movie this year, Atomic Blonde, which I enjoyed a lot. But it's like so 80s. It's telling you every minute this is set in the 80s with the musical cues and the fashions. And this doesn't feel like it has to do that. It just you have that sense of place without them going, hey, it's the 80s. Waka, waka, waka. I don't know. But
so it's nice. Like, obviously, Tom Cruise is not going to work with these kind of auteur directors anymore, I feel. Like, back when he was doing more risky stuff, like Magnolia, around that time, it seemed like he was kind of getting out of that wheelhouse a bit.
Yeah.
But for the kind of wheelhouse that he's in now, like, this is definitely, like, the Tom Cruise that I could get used to.
Yeah.
I just... Like you said, it was just such a despite the fact that he looked nothing like Barry Seal, he was just such a good like everyman type thing.
Yeah, it's all in the performance, and you sometimes see this with actors, and they'll go on cruise control, pun intended.
I was beaten to it.
But this is clearly something that challenged him, and you see him he still does try to challenge things. He did Rock of Ages, right, where it required him to sing. I don't know if he used his real voice or not, but he does occasionally try things, but then he reverts back quickly to doing another Mission Impossible movie or doing a Mummy movie or even something like the Jack Reacher. I was looking forward to the Jack Reacher sequel, but it's a Tom Cruise movie. The first Jack Reacher is not a Tom Cruise movie. The sequel is, and that makes it so dull.
And it comes back to the to what I was saying about it just being safe. You know what I mean? It's like nobody could really hate on Jack Reacher. He's too likable and too...
he's likably gruff.
Yeah, yeah. So it was just such a safe thing, I feel.
Right. The difference is that Jack Reacher doesn't really smile. Jack Reacher, like, scowls.
Right.
But even, like, you're like, oh, Tom Cruise. He's a scowly devil, that one. But it's... Yeah, it's... I would agree that he doesn't really do the Magnolias anymore.
Right.
Or the Born on the 4th of July is anymore.
But I guess we've changed as, an industry.
The industry's changed a lot, too. You don't really get a lot of the Magnolias. Well, P.T. Anderson's still making stuff.
But, true.
he's doing all right. but yeah, the this is Tom Cruise. I think that makes people remember why they like Tom Cruise.
Yes,
and I do think that is a shame. I don't know what the box office on this is. I haven't looked, but I do think it's a shame that it's not. It's certainly what's been happening on the weekend and with the box office numbers. It certainly didn't look. It wasn't going to have an It opening. Let's just say
yes,
or
correct.
It was going to have more like a Mother opening, which makes me also makes me sad because Mother. You reviewed Mother with me, right?
Yes, and I also. Actually, Mother is kind of like in the auteur wheelhouse. Feel that we were just talking about in some ways.
But my point is, you know, we get these movies that aren't sequels, that aren't, you know, remakes or reboots or based on a TV show or adaptations. Yeah. Although I wouldn't exactly compare apples to apples for American Made and Mother, but certainly American Made has more of a crowd-pleasing tinge and desire to crowd-please than Mother does, but it still can't seem to pack them in. Although I will say, I went on Saturday night and it was almost packed. It was probably three quarters to four fifths full theater.
Right.
So this does find an audience. Perhaps we're being overly pessimistic. Perhaps this is something that might be a word of mouth success. I certainly hope so, because I'm not sure how many critically acclaimed films, box office bombs Doug Liman has left in him before he has to try and do something like Jumper.
Because even Edge of Tomorrow, like as fantastic as that was, didn't really like blow the box office away.
And that is such a paradox because it's Tom Cruise, it's an action movie, it's sci-fi, it was a summer release. A lot of people blame the title and, you know, I don't know about that because... I'm not sure how many people look at the title like, well, that doesn't sound like something. Maybe it has an effect. But yeah.
The budget on that was also quite high as well, from what I remember. Like, higher than usual, I feel.
It might have been. I'd have to double check. But still, I guess the point I'm trying to get at is Doug Liman is kind of two for two with like Edge of Tomorrow and this.
Yes,
in terms
absolutely.
Of partnerships with Tom Cruise. And it's a very rewarding partnership when you see it in the theater, and it's a shame that it doesn't seem to be attracting an audience that it deserves. What I will say is that it's a great time, and you know
it is.
It's if nothing else, even though I would criticize it from sort of not dealing with the issues and the politics of it directly.
Yeah, that was but, some of the stuff I felt that they trimmed down a bit, maybe.
Yes, but on the other hand, I'm almost glad of that because it gives you something to talk about, right? And it sort of makes you stop to think. You know, I don't think any particular scene was played for. Well, maybe there was like kind of the one montage where he's like buying his wife a car and he's getting his kids like nice things and computer games and stuff. But I don't think there was ever sort of like – there was never like a rap video quality to it where he's like throwing dollars at – $100 bills at the camera.
Yes.
It's presented in kind of – they're very blase. There's a scene in the trailer. It's also in the movie where his wife says like the dog has dug up one of the bags and there's $100 bills all
over. Bills everywhere,
like, Yeah, I'll rake it up tomorrow. You know, there is a kind of subtext there that, you know, money can make you stupid. Money makes you, you know, bored, and that, you know, one should probably be a bit wiser, especially if you're gaining that money through
the
criminal means
that he was,
through you know, Escobar and Noriega. And there was that great scene where he's with Noriega and they're trading files for money, and they're both stuffing them at the same time, which is just a great visual. But
yeah, it's I guess you're right in that sense. You're not clubbed over the head with these kind of political things the same way you're not clubbed with the, you know, 80s cultural stuff as well.
Yeah,
either way, I think people will just have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I think so too. And if you talk about that stuff after the movie, I think so much the better.
True. But I certainly wanted to know about the real Barry Seal afterwards.
Yeah. And I mean, he was a character. And nothing else, he was a character. And if nothing else, I think, you know, it sort of shows the inelegance of spy work. If you know, we have all these like the Mission Impossible movies, the James Bond movies, the mm-hmm. Bourne movies, where it looks awesome and you're doing awesome things. But underneath it all, there's this mechanism and people getting chewed up and spit out and shot in the head and that are blown up in their car, as we see in this movie.
Yep.
I think that is
a fresh kind of perspective,
right? To see it from like the lower level, the informant level of spy movies. He's not the guy hanging off the plane. He's the guy who, you know, is
like crash landing,
the plane, yes. and trying to get away from the cops.
Right.
But to speak to the 80s time period, yeah, it speaks to, you know, there's a lot of nostalgia for the 80s, but it also speaks to what an incredibly messed up time it was as well.
Yeah,
from
absolutely.
A geopolitical perspective, from like the social perspective and the drugs, and like he was bringing in all this cocaine into the United States, and it wasn't just so it could sit on a shelf.
Yes, absolutely.
And so it's, you know, maybe it's a bit better at the subtext than we think that it's gotten
now
us
that
talking,
we've
but,
yeah,
but yeah,
analyzed it.
To go back to the main point, it is good. Tom Cruise is good. Doug Liman's
yeah.
good, and the woman who plays his wife in it, Sarah Wright, I liked her a lot as well.
Another person I was not familiar with, but
no, I wasn't familiar with her either.
Oh, okay, yeah, she was definitely fantastic.
There's a great scene. It's kind of repeated. It's you know, where he's like, "Do you trust me?" And she's like, "No," which is, seems like such a wife thing to say. And you know, especially when a wife knows her husband, "Do you trust me?" No, of course not. It's crazy. And so she was really good. It was a bit distracting because she looks a bit like Jessica Simpson, but who I don't know what she's up to these days.
That's true. Yeah.
But
let's not go down that.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole. Let's not go down the rabbit hole for once. We've too many rabbit holes on today's show, man. Anyway, so we're both endorsing American Made. It's
yes.
in theaters now. Well worth checking out. And if you want to, you know, give us some feedback on that or anything that's going on with the show, and we'd love to hear from you. You can certainly listen to the show again. It'll be on our website, endreditsradioshow.com. We're on the social medias plural, or mediums. Oh, well. End Credits Radio Show on Facebook, End Credits Radio on Twitter. And Vince, where can people find you on the internet these days?
You can't.
What?
I'm completely and totally obscured. No,
I thought you went native for a minute. That was weird.
You can find me on Facebook, Vincent Masson. Look for the profile picture of the guy that looks like George Clooney, you know? It'll be like super easy to find.
You are the Barry Seal.
Yes.
You're George Clooney's Barry Seal. But you have a show. I'm trying to get you to promote the thing that you're doing coming up. You're showing some of your work. If people want to check out your work.
Oh yes. So we shot about half of a short film prior to me leaving for Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to resume that soon, but. Yeah, so we will be screening the footage that we have at the member screening night at Ed Video,
mm-hmm.
Which of course is the we have many many friends in Ed Video, obviously.
Media Arts Center.
Mentioned them yep. many times. Yeah,
That's at 404 York. That's at Ed Video, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So
404 York Road.
We're looking for like any feedback anybody wants to give us on what we have so far.
Mm-hmm.
It's nobody has seen it yet, so. It's,
and there'll be more than exciting. Vince's work. It's a member screening, so people.
So there will be many. Yes,
they'll be showing what they're doing. And
I don't know if you're just being modest. You are actually like an integral part of this project. So thank
yeah.
you for
oh,
your
my
participation.
Pleasure.
We got a lot of great stuff.
Good
as a result of
and yeah. So yeah, I will be in the films. I will
yes.
be in Vince's film. So you can. It'll be a twofer for you if you want to check that out. If you want to check me out, I will be on here on CFRU later today at 5 p.m. for Open Sources Guelph with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. And that'll be actual news and politics and not masquerading as a movie show. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at M.A. Donaldson or go to GuelphPolitico.blogspot.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next Thursday at 10 a.m. for more end credits. And we will see you then.